Hello and welcome to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and today's guest is not your typical activist. Madeleine Kay is a 23-year-old artist and ardent Remain campaigner from Sheffield, and she uses her craft to fight for a cause. From getting kicked out of a Brussels press conference for being dressed up as EU Supergirl to writing a song called Strong and Stable My Ass, Madeleine has done it all. Now she's also fronting a new Ring Your Granny campaign to bring around a second EU referendum, so we brought her on today to talk about how viable an option this is. We also discuss why art is such an effective vehicle for political opinions and why the future of campaigning and protesting will look more like Project Fun than Project Fear, so stay tuned to hear all about that. And while you're at it, please do subscribe to us wherever you're listening and let us know your thoughts on this or any other episode. We're at Brexit Podcast everywhere or at brexitpodcast.com. So I just want to start off by talking a bit about your career, really, as a campaigner and an activist, because I think you're not the first thing that sort of comes to mind when a lot of people think about how activists work. So, for example, you dressed up as an EU Supergirl when you attended the European Week of Regions and Cities in Brussels. And you also have a couple of other costumes up your sleeve that you use for campaigning. So I'm curious why you use costumes and what are the other costumes?
So the other costumes that I use, I've got a pirate saboteur outfit, and we've got placards that say Brexit is suicide with a skull and crossbones on. I have a teammate who has matching costumes, and also my dog as well. We get her dressed up too. I've also done a UKIP dragon, like a purple and yellow dragon. and just recently for Halloween, I did zombie Theresa May. And the reason why I do the costumes is because, well, firstly, it makes people laugh. Amuses them and entertains them. But it gets their attention, and because it's so visual, and when you've got photographs and videos and stuff, and you share that, and it attracts attention, it attracts retweets, it gets people talking, and it engages people in a way that a block of text wouldn't necessarily.
So what was it you were trying to bring across when you dressed up as EU Supergirl for that event?
Well, the EU Supergirl outfit was originally for a protest march in Manchester outside the Tory party conference. And I had my friend Dominic dressed up as EU Superman, and Alba, my dog, dressed up as EU Superwolf. And the concept behind that was Britain needs a superhero to save it from Brexit. And it's a really kind of positive message about the EU doing good things, and that's why I decided to take it with me when I went to Brussels, because obviously, you know, you've got a lot more sort of Europhilic people there who would support that, and I also discovered whilst I was there that there is a guy from Brussels who dresses up as Captain Europe, who gets invited to the social events that the European Commission hold. So it was really great when I got to meet him and got some photos with him as well. The reason why I wore the Supergirl costume to the press conference was because I wanted to make a visual statement to David Davis that there is a Remain movement that don't support what him and his party are doing regarding the Brexit negotiations.
So even though you would assume that being in Brussels, people are quite Europhilic and would enjoy an EU Supergirl, you somehow still got kicked out of the press conference while you were there. What was that like, and why do you think you were kicked out?
I know why I was kicked out, because I was told they were scared that I was going to pull a stunt like the guy at the Tory party conference. That was literally the reason that was given to me.
Did you ever debate it, pulling a stunt?
What did I?
Did you ever debate pulling something quite as dramatic as what happened at the Tory Party conference, or were you literally just there because you wanted to be sort of a silent protester?
Yeah, no, I wasn't planning on doing anything because I, you know, I'd been signed into the building by a friend, you know, the rule is that if you're not with an accredited media association, you're not allowed to ask a question. And, you know, I was going to respect that because I didn't want her to get in trouble. So I literally just went in and sat at the front, waiting for the press conference to start. But because I was wearing the Supergirl outfit, that attracted a lot of attention and it delayed the start of the press conference, which was when the commissioner that was in charge sort of sent the security over to get me out. There wasn't a legal basis for it. Rejecting me. It was just that it was causing disruption.
Was it quite intimidating at the time in front of this entire room of people being asked to leave like that?
I'm not intimidated by people in suits. I don't know. I think my attitude is that if you want to engage more people in politics, if you want to reach out to a wider citizen participation, then you've got to have more kind of approachable and alternative means of communication. And I think that it is a mistake to sort of like hold, you know, to have this kind of official protocol for everything and not accept any diversity within that. So in throwing me out of the press conference, I wasn't the one in the wrong. So no, I wasn't intimidated and I wasn't really bothered about it. The aim of the game was to get media attention for the Remain campaign and I achieved that. So I sort of accomplished what I'd gone in for anyway.
In general, throughout your career, you've sort of made it your thing to protest in these ways that aren't necessarily what people associate you with protesting. You don't just always just hold a placard and march through the streets. You've written multiple songs like Strong and Stable, My Ass, and you're currently working on the Rage Against the Brexit Machine album. You've also made a children's book about the refugee crisis and wrote a book called Theresa May in Brexit Land. What is it about art and communicating activism through art that's so effective, or why do you think it is so effective?
Well, the Leave campaign won because of populism and because of, you know, this kind of like drum banging nationalism, highly visual images of, you know, the red bus, the Breaking Point poster, all these things that gauge people on an emotional level. And you know, I've heard AC Grayling say politics is about sentiment, and it's absolutely true. People voted for Leave based on very, very little understanding and very, very little knowledge about the EU, what most people did. And you know, I frequently encounter people on protest events, marches, Brexit voters that will come and disrupt our protests, and I always make a point of having a conversation with them, not in a confrontational way, but in a polite way, because you know, we need to understand where the Leave vote came from. And I have yet to hear a coherent and convincing argument for why, you know, that's based on facts, that's based on evidence, that's based on rational argument for why we should leave the EU. And that has led me to realise that we're not going to win the vote back by presenting the facts and the rational argument. That's what the Remain campaign did before the referendum. That was Project Fear. And I'm sorry, but Project Fear doesn't work because people don't care. You know, you tell them this bad thing will happen, this bad thing will happen. It goes over the head. They say, so what? Things are pretty rubbish already. Bring it on. Now, what I think we need to do instead of Project Fear is we need to do Project Fun. And we need to have all of the evidence and the facts to back up what we're doing, but we need to present it in a in a fun and engaging and inspiring way that's going to make the European Union, a membership of the European, provide hope and optimism to people that are in, you know, struggling, deprived areas of the UK, and make them believe that Brexit is not the solution to the problems, and to actually believe in the EU again. And this is something that the EU needs to do across the board in every member state. If they want to fight the rise in populism, if they want to win support for the European Union, they have got to change their attitude. You know, it's not all about grey suits and press conferences. And they need to reach out to a wider pool of citizens. And they've got to do it in a way that's going to engage people that aren't typically interested in politics.
So could you run me a bit more through the kinds of ways in which you've tried to execute Project Fun, and sort of also other suggestions that you could think of in which it could be executed?
So I've written and illustrated 4 books, and they've all got social and political themes. One of them's actually about environmental politics rather than anything to do with Brexit. But 3 of them are children's books, and one of them's Trees Maybe in Brexit Land is more for adults. And they're all, you know, quite lighthearted ways of dealing with very, very serious issues that need to be talked about in this country. And, you know, across the EU, you know, things like the refugee crisis. The children's book, Go Back to Where You Came From, which I wrote, is for children. And it's a way of sort of having conversations about refugees and also wider diversity issues, because there's an LGBT family in it as well. It's about trying to educate children, young people, but in a way that they can understand and they can engage with, that's not going to frighten them, and it's not going to, you know, worry them, but it's going to make them aware of the issues. Other things I do are writing the songs. I've had a whole collection of songs. One of my most popular from last year at Christmas time was All I Want for Christmas is EU. And that video went quite viral. And that is again about, you know, engaging people, entertaining them, but also getting the message across. You know, the lyrics are about, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May and, you know, issues with relating to democracy and, you know, the sort of lies that were told behind the Remain campaign. But it's done in, you know, a fun and engaging way. Yeah, I mean, there's loads and loads of projects, creative campaigning projects, that are being done by the Remain campaign. There's a documentary coming out that I'm actually in called Postcards from the 48%, and he's done interviews with Bob Geldof and Nick Clegg and Alistair Campbell and all the, you know, the key Remainers, and that's a documentary film. And, you know, one thing that I'd really like to do, you know, before March 2019 is to actually have like a gallery exhibition with, you know, lots of, you know, artwork and the satirical cartoons and things that have been produced in, you know, over the, you know, relating to Brexit, and, you know, sort of encourage conversation about whether it is still a good idea. Why people voted leave and whether to go forward with it.
So do you think that's the sort of future of political campaigning and activism going forward, not sort of just very staunch placards and marches or policy involvement or think tanks, but sort of fun? Do you think that's going to catch on across a broader spectrum of people?
Well, I think you need both. Because I don't think you can have, you know, the fun without the facts behind it. You definitely need a combined effort. But no, certainly. I mean, you know, companies employ PR firms to, you know, to do branding, to do marketing, etc. That's essentially what I'm doing for the Remain campaign. It's given it a brand, it's given it a you know, a friendly public face, and it's, you know, distributing it via social media channels and raising awareness for that brand and for that campaign. I wouldn't describe myself as a political activist primarily. I describe myself as a writer and an artist, but the themes that I'm working with at the moment are all politically based. I kind of see myself as a facilitatory mechanism for the Remain campaign. It's what I'm doing is communicating the message, communicating the facts, but in a different way, in a way that's going to connect with different groups that, you know, wouldn't otherwise be engaged or interested.
So you're also fronting a new Ring Your Granny campaign, in which young people sort of persuaded to talk to their older relatives to oppose Brexit. And I think this was also credited with sort of getting the gay marriage legalization thing across in Ireland in 2015. So can you walk me through what sort of, how that would work in practice? What's the idea behind it?
So this campaign's actually starting in January, and the idea is that it's going to run up till, you know, March 2019, when Brexit is supposedly happening. And it's based on the model that was used in Ireland to change the views of older Conservative voters about gay marriage. And it was hugely successful. And they, you know, they got the bill through, and now gay marriage is legal in Ireland. And the idea is to use that same model, but regarding Brexit. So there's a generational divide over Brexit. I'm not saying that every old person voted for Brexit. Absolutely not saying that. But statistically, more older people voted for Brexit and more younger people voted for Remain. So working, you know, on a very generalized basis, what we're trying to do is get the young people that voted for Remain to talk to their older relatives that voted for Leave, and to find out, you know, try and work out why they voted Leave, and then try and change their minds, basically. Because one of the big issues over Brexit is that it's very difficult to have rational argument about it, because a lot of people didn't vote for rational reasons. They voted for emotional reasons. And then when you try to confront those emotional reasons, you're going to get an emotional reaction, which is usually anger. And, you know, coming from a random campaigner or politician or whatever, people aren't going to listen. But if it's somebody that you know personally, someone that you care about, someone that you love, who wants to come and talk to you, you're more likely to be receptive. So that's why we want younger people to engage with their family members. And, you know, by no means are we saying that there aren't older people that voted Remain that could also support this initiative by talking to their friends that voted Leave, or even talking to their grandchildren that may have voted Leave as well, because I know there are young people that vote for Leave too. So I think the campaign needs to be quite diverse in terms of its approach. But yeah, the principle is that it's young people who vote to Remain, ring your granny and change their minds.
From personal experience, it can be quite hard to convince, especially someone older who might already be sort of quite set in their views. Obviously, massive generalization, but I have found this personally with my grandparents, for example, when I've tried to talk to them about it. So what do you think is the way to go about this in conversation?
I don't have any grandparents left anymore, and I'm not entirely sure how they would have voted had they been alive, because they were lifelong Tory supporters, but they were quite supportive of, you know, traveling and European values and stuff. So, me personally, I've not had experience of this conversation, but I would think it's the way that you'd have to go about it would be to say, you know, if you care about me, if you love me, then please listen to what I want. And, you know, it's got to be an emotional argument. And it's got to be done with compassion, and it's got to be done through listening as well, because there's no point sort of just telling people what to think and what to do. That never works. You've got to listen to their views, and try and find, you know, compromise and solution that actually is most beneficial for everyone.
So clearly you are a Remainer, continue to be a Remainer, and it sounds like your ultimate aim is to sort of stop or reverse Brexit. And obviously right now there's a massive debate going on about whether that's a possibility, and whether, even if it is a possibility, whether that's sort of a productive way forwards, considering how far down the line we've already gotten. So I'm curious to hear your sort of reasoning for thinking that A, it's still possible to stop Brexit, and B, that it would be the most productive way forward.
Well, it's perfectly possible. You know, take a rare piece of advice from David Davis, and use a bit of imagination. The EU have said that Article 50 can be withdrawn at any point, which means that it's, you know, it can be done. What needs to happen in order for that to occur is that we've got to change the minds of enough people, because obviously it was a democratic vote, albeit based on lies and misinformation, and, you know, one of the only ways to reverse that is to have another democratic vote, but this time we want one that's based on the facts and the evidence and the information. And, you know, now that we actually know what Brexit is, when we know what Brexit is, because we were asked to vote for Brexit and everyone voted for Brexit for their own reasons. There was, you know, there was no specification about what Brexit actually was. So when the Tories serve up whatever they managed to negotiate or fail to negotiate in Brussels, that may or may not be what people had, you know, initially voted for. And we didn't write the government a blank check. You know, if David Davis comes back from Brussels with a turd in a box and says, hey, this is Brexit, would we accept that? No, we wouldn't. So I think it is absolutely perfectly legitimate to ask for a referendum on the deal, you know, a ratification referendum. And what we have to do in the meantime is we have to change people's minds. You know, when by presenting the realities of Brexit, you know, we're seeing banks and businesses moving abroad, losing jobs. The money that was promised for the NHS is not going to materialise. Instead, we're paying apparently 8,000 civil servants to, you know, to sort out all the headaches from Brexit. We've lost NHS nurses from the EU. We've lost skilled labour, migrant labour. We're losing low-skilled migrant labour to do the jobs that British people don't want to do, like picking fruit. There's so many reasons. And the more and more that come to light, I think the more and more that people's minds, you know, are going to start doubting the whole project.
So what needs to happen for there to be that sort of ratification referendum once the deal is presented? Who could set something like that in motion? Would it need to be Theresa May and her government? Could that come from outside, from Parliament? How would that work?
I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, on the 11th of December, there is a debate in Parliament over a petition for the second referendum on the terms of exit. So we'll have to wait and see what the outcome of that is. I'm not highly optimistic about it, but that is obviously showing that there's a huge amount of public support for another referendum on the terms of exit. It probably does need to come from the government, because obviously they have the majority in the House of Commons. But I think if there's enough public pressure, then, you know, it can and should be done.
So how, say this, the ratification referendum does happen, how do you feel about the chances of people actually voting differently? I hate to bring up the sort of ever-present comparison of America, but it feels like while for a lot of Democrats, obviously the Trump administration has been nothing short of a shit show. I think there have been polls amongst Trump voters and they're actually really happy with how it's going and they see everything is going really smoothly, even though everyone's like, see, this is what we've said all along. It doesn't work. So do you think there's any chance of in the UK that sort of same thing happening where we have another referendum and people vote the same way again because they are happy with the way things are going?
Yeah, that's perfectly possible. But I think, I don't know, we have to keep trying, because at the end of the day, Remainers want what is in the best interests of the country. And the fact that a lot of Leave voters in deprived regional areas voted to leave the EU because there's been this ongoing slur campaign in the right-wing press blaming the EU for what are actually the failings of domestic policy. You know, for example, immigration, the EU in Article 7 has very specific outlines about about immigration, about making sure that people that come into the country aren't a burden on the state. And it's the UK government that have been failing to implement that. You know, all the regional development funding that happens in like the Northeast and Wales, which voted extremely heavily for Leave, is not properly publicised. In Sheffield, there are no EU flags over any of our EU-funded projects. And basically, you then get people in these areas who are saying, oh, well, what's the EU done for our area? They've done nothing. And that's not true. And those people who voted most highly for Leave are the ones that are going to be most negatively affected by the impacts of Brexit. And we have got to keep fighting Brexit for those people, for the people that voted Leave, mistakenly thinking that they're going to be better off outside of the EU because they categorically are not. And, you know, we're not doing this for our own, you know, because, well, we are doing it for our own self-interest, but we're doing it for the interests of everyone. And it's quite, I find it quite perverse that the Leave campaign was led by individuals that have, you know, ulterior self-interested motivations for it. And they've basically convinced people that are ignorant to vote for something that's going to damage them.
You're really, really invested in sort of the European project. And I think you're also the communications officer for the Young European Movement. Is that right?
Not anymore. I was.
You were. Okay.
They've recently had a change of board, but my commitments have got a bit... I've basically got too many, so I've dropped that position.
Understandable with everything going on. So I'm curious why... I suppose why you believe in it that strongly, because the stereotype, I suppose, is that in the UK there was never quite that understanding of the European project and that community feeling with the rest of the continent, I suppose. So why is it that you do believe in it that way?
Well, I think that's wrong that, you know, that we don't have the community feeling with the rest of the European project. I believe in it because... you know, I grew up in a multicultural household. Both my parents are university academics. We had their master's students living with us as lodgers throughout the whole of my childhood. I was exposed to a lot of cultures. And, you know, a lot of my parents' friends and colleagues, you know, come from across the world, come from the EU, and their livelihood, their jobs, their homes, you know, are all being threatened by Brexit. And I've worked in France on my gap year. I worked at a children's activity centre, leading tours and things, and teaching French children English. And you know, I think it's really great. Those experiences are really important, and I think, you know, the Brexit vote is taking those opportunities away from the next generation. And I know from facts and research and information that the EU has done a lot of good for this country. Now, I think it's a great injustice that that hasn't been properly publicised and that has been communicated, and people aren't educated about what the EU does or how it operates. You know, I'm sick of being told that the EU is undemocratic when it isn't. MEPs are directly elected. The Council of Europe is directly elected. So the laws are made by the European Commission, which isn't directly elected, but the MEPs have the final say in all those laws, and they can alter them in any way that they want or reject them. So, you know, claiming that it's undemocratic is nonsense. It's just lies, basically. And I think we've done the EU a great disservice. And, you know, ultimately, I want what is best for the country and, you know, best for the deprived areas. I want to reduce inequality in the country. And the way to do that is not leaving the EU. And that's why I'm determined to fight it.
I suppose I'm personally a bit worried about the way that a second referendum might impact tensions in this country, which are already so high. Do you think that it might also, that having a second referendum might have a negative impact in terms of people feeling wronged on the Leave side, and then people feeling perhaps, again, not wanting to generalise, but feeling quite satisfied on the Remain side, and then that driving even more of a wedge between people rather than bringing people together again?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge problem. And, you know, it was caused by the fact that there was this referendum in the first place, which should never have been called. Referenda are a terrible way of solving political issues. You know, our relationship with the EU is such a complex issue, and it's not, I'm not in any way saying that it's perfect. The EU needs reform, but, you know, it's better reformed from inside. You know, we can't reform it from the outside. And it is going to be very, very difficult to solve this issue now, this problem now that it's been caused. And, you know, given the behaviour of groups like the EDL and, you know, British National Party and, you know, the banned nationalist groups, there is a significant chance that another referendum will result in violence, riots, or, you know, we already see people being furious on social media, and that's only going to heighten, that's only going to get worse. And I actually think that social media abuse needs to be more severely dealt with, actually. I think people think they can get away with saying things on social media that is just totally unacceptable.
Yeah, we've dealt with that a couple of times on the podcast, because we've had Gina Miller on, who obviously brought sort of the legal case against the government, and the amount of online abuse that she's faced has been absolutely outrageous. So have you experienced that yourself?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. To the point, I've even had rape threats, actually.
So how do you deal with that?
Sometimes I ignore it. Quite often my strategy for dealing with it is actually to call it out. Because I've got a huge positive following on social media of, you know, people that support me in my campaigning. And if I and being trolled viciously, you know, on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter or anywhere, I will call it out and say, hey guys, can someone come stick up for me? Or, you know, if it's an abusive comment, or if it's somebody, quite often on social media, I'll get somebody sort of, you know, asking for evidence or reasons, or they actually sort of willingly asking for knowledge, why we want to overturn democracy or whatever it is. And quite often calling that out is a good way of getting, you know, people to present their facts and their argument and actually start a debate. So sometimes it's quite a good strategy as well. But, you know, sometimes it's best to ignore it and leave and block. And I do frequently block people that aren't prepared to have a civilized debate and argument. You know, I'm all up for debating and talking. We have to talk to people that vote to leave. We have to. But if they are literally just going to be aggressive and abusive, then it's a pointless argument to have anyway. So those people are blocked.
So lastly, before I let you go, the people that sort of agree with your mission and want to get involved in the things you're doing, how can they do that?
Well, I mean, join the online communities. I recently sat in the audience of a panel debate on hyperconnectivity, and everyone on that panel was, you know, an older person that, you know, one of them was a self-confessed troglodyte, didn't know how to use social media, and they were all cursing social media for the ills that it's causing the world. But actually, in terms of campaigning, I think it's been a huge, huge, you know, facilitatory mechanism to create this support network of really positive individuals, you know, people that have helped me crowdfund for books. So join those communities, you know, like the pages on Facebook, follow the accounts on Twitter, watch the YouTube videos, share the content and the messages, but also physical engagement and participation. You know, when you find out about an event on social media, then turn up for it, you know, go to the marches, support the crowdfunders. You know, I'm crowdfunding Brexit Christmas cards at the moment for people to send out, and those will be printed, and it's a physical thing that people can use at Christmas time. We're also about to do a project called Letters to Europe, where we're taking 1,000 handwritten letters over to Brussels and possibly Germany and Netherlands and stuff as well. We're going to hand them out at Christmas time, so, you know, people can write a letter for us, submit it online, or, you know, they can support the crowdfunder for that project, or, you know, there's lots of ways to be involved, but it's the most important thing is to be part of those networks and part of those online communities, so that, you know, you're aware of what's going on and you can choose to engage how you want.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And there are new episodes of the podcast every Tuesday and Thursday. So if you want to get those and stay up to date on all the Brexit news and opinions of the day, please do subscribe to us wherever you're listening right now. And that way you can get them sent straight to your phone. You can also find us pretty much anywhere at Brexit Podcast. And the show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, Ollie Dagmar, and Warren Paul, with a theme song by Kevin MacLeod.